My name's Moin Yassin. I'm the founder director of Global Vision 2000, which is an independent think tank specializing in the Islamic world, global Islamic world, and of global political economy. Global Vision, there's a long history. Basically, it's formulated into an active think tank, which is trying to understand, the Islamic message in a comprehensive, universal manner. But the terminology we use might sound not Islamic. We talk about a universal paradigm shift, for instance. So we have been articulating a universal message for a long time, actually, and developing a philosophy, language, outreach globally.
Yeah, well, one of the main problems is, exactly as with Judaism, is there are all sorts of attempts to... Vast amounts of money seems to have been spent on hijacking Islam, all sorts of institutions, new organisations being set up, terrorist groups that are calling themselves inspired by the Quran. But we see exactly the same, of course, with the Crusades and Christianity, and we see the same with Zionism and Judaism. So can you just give us an introduction to how you came to understand that there are all these difficult issues within Islam particularly, and who it is that's trying to hijack it in this way?
Well, that's a profound question. I suppose you need to go back to Adam, the creation of Adam and Eve, really, about the purpose of, indeed it's quite relevant, not a distraction, about the purpose of man being on earth and his mission, talking about mission. In Islam, after the, what do you want to call it, the outcasting of Adam and Eve to earth, the idea was really to give Adam a chance to orientate himself as a true creature in submission to God's sovereignty and will. So we're here as a test, or a test for humanity, not just Muslims. And that is the plot that humanity has again, in a sense, forgotten. That there is a purpose, a meaning, and an end to humanity's existence on planet Earth. We're now, 8 billion? Quite a story. 8 billion humans, the Iblis was also thrown out, and his job is to subvert the test or make it difficult, and to make the orientation, I use the word orientation, of man to God's sovereignty a disaster, a failure, a disaster leading to everyone coming to hell with him. So,
you haven't quite answered my question about who's behind this, because I pointed out that you've got the Crusades in medieval times, got modern things like Al Qaeda and Al Nusra. Which most Islamic scholars will attribute more to intelligence services than and private arms companies and geopolitical forces than they will to them being inspired by the Quran or anything specific. And the same, of course, as I say, with the Zionist project, which now looks as if these people who are attaching themselves to what Christians would call the Old Testament or the Torah, they're attaching themselves to that, but it looks like they're bringing hell to the Holy Land. So obviously this is not what is desired by God or by the scriptures. So who is behind this?
Well, as I said, we have to take this seriously, what I've said. I've gone back to day one, Adam on earth. but also the police, the shaitan. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that the Satan and the Dajjalic power or forces, there's an army of them, they are using many techniques and organizations to mislead Muslims and humanity. I'm not prepared to say it's just one. You could refer to empires, you could refer to Freemasonry, you could refer to, oligarchs and what have you. There's many forces. I wouldn't say there's just one to subvert humanity and Muslims.
Now I'm chatting to you on the week before the anniversary of the September the 11th attacks.
I see.
When we first kind of came across each other in the UK as the organisation which called itself the 9/11 Truth Movement started. What we were doing was trying to use online discussion forums and any other mediums, including big public meetings, etc., speaking tours of the UK in order to raise awareness about the September the 11th attacks. So can you say, because, I mean, this was the project for the new American century. The idea seemed to be to set the new century off on a very bad foot in 2001, September the 11th, by this massive attack on New York and on Washington. So can you just say what you think in a nutshell? I know it's a long, difficult question, but in a nutshell, what you think we've now learned. So it's now 24 years on from September the 11th attacks. What we've learned in that period about what happened and who did it?
Well, that's very specific. Now you're pointing to a specific event and the forces behind it. Definitely, I would blame, the big enemy, the Satan behind it. However, specifically, it was quite clear. In my writings, I refer to the global GWAT, Global War of Terror, not against terror, but Global War of Terror. So basically, this was obviously the military, industrial, intelligence complex, definitely, what do you want to call it, deep state. However, the more I didn't used to at the beginning because I didn't have the evidence, but there was some. But I'm prepared to say that given what we're seeing of the Israel now, I call Israel in my writings. I've noticed some other online channels are using that term. I'm prepared to say it was a Zionist, a combination of the satanic Zionazi Israel regime working in conjunction with the deep state or the military-industrial complex of the US to have a new crusade, as you mentioned, yes, or the global war of terror. In other words, the controlled demolition using thermite, which melted the buildings, nothing else could have melted it so quickly, was used as a pretext and also to gain the consent and legitimize these wars against the Islamic world. And the wars aren't just about Iraq, sorry, Afghanistan initially, then Iraq, but you could argue even the follow-on regime change, move to regime change wars and using WMD and Libya, Syria, and other countries. It's all part of that. And indeed, you could. In other words, I'm arguing there's a continuity of wars since 9/11. They've come through different waves or phases, and I think we're on another wave just now with the Greater Israel project, which is nothing new, by the way. I mean, all these plans to take out different countries, to weaken the Islamic world, to control the Islamic world. It's nothing new, really, but the plans are real-time.
Well, hang on, because what we know is that the airliners were flown into the Twin Towers in New York by hijackers who weren't actually from Afghanistan. They were Saudi citizens. And also, of course, the Pentagon, was also hit by an airliner. Another airliner was brought down, but I think it was in Shanksville. What is it about these stories that you find difficult to fathom? Because that's the official story. Still, that's the official story of what happened. Airliners were hijacked by Saudi citizens, and the idea was to try to intimidate the United States into submission. Apparently, Bin Laden had been given the task to do this. It was a deliberate terrorist attack as a way of really retaliating against the United States' influence, particularly in the Middle East and the Islamic world.
Yes, I mean, Muslims have got many legitimate grievances against the not just the American empire, but global non-Muslim hegemons, if that's the word. I was about to write an editorial, so I'm looking at various books on 9/11. I mean, the bottom line is, to answer your question, I remember on Islam Channel, a Muslim who was involved in massive marches against the Iraq war asked me the question about conspiracy. The point is that, you know, I've been around now and written a lot. I mean, the point is, yes, there is a conspiracy. However, the conspiracy is satanic, as I mentioned, from day one, from Adam and his followers. So everything, and notice what I just said, everything, and I've written this about all these wars against Muslims, everything they are saying is a pack of lies. I've got books here in front of me by Griffin, 9/11 Commission Report, The Holy War, 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism, Webster Tapley, and so on. I mean, everything, the Rogue State, William Blum, Ian Henschel, I mean, everything they say, by that I mean the non-Muslim, advocates of the global war on terror, they are the terrorists. And one of the key weapons in promoting the narrative is deception, lies, total pack of lies. I would say I believe nothing of the official narrative. For instance, you just said to me this official story is some hijackers, yeah? What if I say to you the latest research says thermite was used? You'll say, how can you prove that? White non-Muslim researchers, I think from Denmark and elsewhere, have found from the dust particles, which can be proven, that thermite was used. And what is thermite? It's a nuclear-grade, military-grade material, which melts material. So you can see the difference about the depth of the evil. So basically, I must confess, I don't think there's any need to go through chapter and verse like Ian Henschel and others about X, Y, Z, because really it's all minutiae. Some of it is guesswork, etc., etc., building up a jigsaw. My argument is you've got to look at the big picture. Is it possible, from a scientific argument, one does have to ask the question, does jet fuel lead to that, or was it something else? Was it almost like a nuclear explosion or a semi-nuclear? And if it was, which I do believe, and it is proven it was, what did it lead to? It led to millions who have been slaughtered in these various countries I've mentioned.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, there's something slightly unreal about the idea of a fire which is made of, as you say, kerosene or paraffin, which is jet fuel, which actually is quite difficult to ignite. If you light a match and stick it into paraffin, the match will go out. It just goes, and it goes.
Yeah, yeah.
And those fires were nearly out. The whole entire building, right our way down to the bottom, should collapse. Now, it looks great, spectacular on the TV. But if you start, you know, even start looking into the science, there are all sorts of questions. Then there's the matter of Building 7, which collapsed into its... without any plane having hit it or anything at all. The fires in it were fairly minor. So that collapse was announced on the BBC in a script, like a film or a play or a drama. before it had even happened. So the picture of the building is still behind the woman, Jane Daly, on the BBC, who then says, well, we're sorry, we've just heard that this building has collapsed. Well, it was stood right behind her in the picture. There it is, still there. So somehow the wires got crossed. The building didn't get brought down at the right time. The building was destroyed by controlled demolition after it supposedly should have been, and after the script got sent, the drama got sent to the BBC, and they read it out as if it was a news report. So there's all sorts of things which question these events, like the ability, for example, to remote control aircraft. You know, so it may be that the aircraft flew somewhere, passengers got off who were plainclothes military, and another aircraft with the same codes on board completed the flight into New York, and actually nobody maybe died in the aircraft at all, especially if the planes had been swapped. So there's loads of questions about that. Obviously, you're right about the consequences, particularly in the Middle East. This idea of breaking up countries, invading countries, bombing countries, very difficult to get the public and politicians' consent for that, and even military consent for it, without some sort of event, and then bouncing everyone into it, like literally the next day, which is what they did with the invasion of Afghanistan. They already announced what had happened. They'd done a thorough investigation. They found out who'd done it. But that sounds much more like a script for a film rather than journalism and news. So this dislike for the United States, of the United States for Islam, can you say what you think is at the bottom of that? Because every time I hear about this, I start to think about the dislike that Adolf Hitler and the Nazis had for the Jews during the Second World War, although they had not so much dislike for Zionist Jews. Any Jews that were prepared to go over to Palestine, they seemed to not mind that at all, and they packed them off there. But the ones that said, no, we're not going, they decided they wanted to genocide them all and do mass murder of millions of Jews that refused to become Zionists. So, you know, I worry that history might be repeating itself. In those days, it was the Jews. Now it may be the Muslims. But what do you think is the reason why the United States has got this dislike of Islam?
Well, that's a huge question and very good and pertinent question. I mean, it depends on how you want to handle the beast, if you want to call it that. For instance, you know, I've been doing, you know, on our website, you ask me what we do or the format. I mean, research is critical, and we've now got thousands of videos, and we've got one thread on Islamic military history. I think maybe you need to go back to Columbus, actually, and the discovery of the New World. Do you know why the Europeans, let me put the question to you, why did Columbus, right after the fall of the only Islamic kingdom in Europe, after its demise and expulsion, more or less, up to 1609, 1490 to 1609, why do you think there was a big push to discover the Americas? That is maybe at the beginning of all the story.
It's a good question. I can you just explain to me what event you're talking about, the expulsion, and when it took place and what happened?
I think it's critical, not just to Americans, but the Western animus. Well, basically, you're talking about you had the 1453, just a few years before 1492, the conquest of Constantinople, where I'm at, right? And the Muslim effort started in the 8th century, 1717, by the Umayyad Caliphate. That's the Arabs, when they were on the rise vis-a-vis the Byzantine Empire. And they were unable to conquer Constantinople until 1453, okay? And that was a huge blow to Christendom in terms of political power, esteem, dare I say, and indeed the threat of Islam, not from the Arabs, but from the Turks. So the only other kingdom that the Muslims had in Europe at that time was from 711 to 1492. The remainder of Islamic Spain was the southern kingdom of Granada. Okay? Because of Muslim disunity, etc., etc., fragmentation, it was terminated. Now, the point I'm making is, in terms of the contest for power, the Europeans for trade and all the rest of it, trade routes, navigation, could not have easy access to the East, yeah, Asia, because of the fact that the Mediterranean was a more or less a Muslim lake. Do you follow so far?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Suez, East Med. So they had to find a way to circumnavigate that. And that is the origins of America, albeit not by Anglo-Saxons, but Spaniards initially. So the origins of America was by, I suppose, the papacy at that time, not Protestants, to find a way to circumvent Muslim control of trade routes and power in the region. And, you know, that was the way to do it, you know, to go around them.
Yeah, well, hang on, because surely the Muslims weren't in the Americas. I mean, you know, we have to be quite careful what language we use. Everyone, certainly in my generation, was taught, well, Columbus discovered America. In fact, he came to the Caribbean and South America, whereas John Cabot from Bristol came to North America a couple of years after. Yeah. Columbus is 1492, John Cabot is 1497. And obviously,
correct,
civilization there. I think there's a lot of evidence, it's well worth adding this in, that the Phoenicians and their galleys had been sailing across to the Americas for a very long time before that. There's lots of evidence for that, particularly in the similarities between the building of the pyramids in Egypt, etc., and in around the Mediterranean, and those pyramids built in South America. So it's pretty clear from also from the evidence of Philip Beale, who built a ship a few years ago, a Phoenician galley, a genuine one, the former Royal Naval officer, and sailed it with great ease over to the Caribbean, and then went to the Florida Yacht Club with it and started to make a few complaints about Columbus, and then got thrown out, because this is somebody who is actually doing real history rather than so anyway, this was really the beginning of a genocide in the South Americas. Now, I'm not saying that these civilizations were great, you know, amongst the Aztecs, etc., there was head chopping going on, child sacrifice, human sacrifice of all sorts, horrific.
Yes.
But the fact is, around about 100 million were murdered in North and South America combined by the efforts of the successors to John Cabot in North America and Christopher Columbus in the Caribbean and South America. So this was a massive colonization. I suppose you're right. You know, what was going on was that these people were looking for land. They were being pushed back by the Muslims. And so they decided to go west instead, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's my argument. I think you've clarified what I just said, the North American dimension vis-a-vis the Latin or Southern, Central and Southern. Mind you, I've done research on that. There is evidence that the Muslims had also, from West Africa, hit the shores of Central and Southern America. I don't want to go into that. There's videos on that, but I'm just given my this is fresh thinking, basically. If you go to Jazeera, which I look at, TRT or whatever, English medium channels, you know, when they look at the Middle East currently, Israel and all the rest of it, and America, you know, it's all the last post Second World War, maybe First World War. But I think we need to go back to the discovery of the Americas and what was the push, the urge. So my point is, I think we need to look at the Vatican files carefully. But I think, you know, we're also humans. We've got intellect. We've got to connect the dots. So that's why I mentioned 1453. That was a huge body blow to Christendom, what you call physically, you know, a capital city of what, a thousand, a millennium or whatever, connected to the Roman Empire or the Christian, the Roman Christianity.
Hang on, though, because it wasn't, was it? It was the Byzantine Empire.
Yeah, but the two were connected. Constantine, you know, there, I guess there was a division.
Around about the time you're talking about, 1453, this was a big. There was a lot of competition going on between the Orthodox Church, which was based in the Byzantine Empire, Constantinople, which is Istanbul, and Rome. And this had been expressed itself, in fact, through the Crusades too. Not a lot of people realised that there was as much animosity by the Crusaders towards their own Christian fellows in Constantinople and the Orthodox Church, we now call the Orthodox Church, which is the original church, that as there was towards Muslims. And in fact, there was a horrific siege in 1203 by the Templars. I think it was the Third Crusade, I'm not sure. But anyway, this was horrific, but it was lifted. The siege was lifted. And then the next year, they came back again in 1204 and absolutely destroyed their own fellow Christians, supposed fellow Christians, in Constantinople. So this was another siege which happened a couple of hundred years, 250 years before the siege you're talking about. And so poor old, you do feel sorry for the Byzantine Empire and Constantinople. It's like everybody's after them. Their own supposed fellow Christians, the Knights Templar, who really, if you look into it, were not at all Christian. They were a military force which had were above the law. They could they were only could be sanctioned by the Vatican, so they could trot round England, France, anywhere they wanted in Europe, and the law couldn't touch them because they were supposed to be holy knights from Rome. But they used this, they abused this all the time, and of course then they inspired lots of killing. But people don't realise necessarily that it was them that finally, they put this horrific siege onto Constantinople in 1204, which everyone was slaughtered. There were rivers of blood in Constantinople, and this was not done by Muslims. This was done by Christians beforehand. So when the siege you're talking about in 1453 by the Ottoman Empire was like another blow 250 years later. So somebody didn't like the Orthodox Church. Somebody didn't like the Byzantine Empire. Someone didn't like Orthodox Christianity.
I can't dispute that. However, let me give you a counter argument. After the conquest of Constantinople, do you realise this is a very unique part of European history? For instance, the Ottoman army, remember the Ottomans took over or entered Anatolia, or what is called Turkey now, 1071 for the Seljuks. They could have taken Constantinople several hundred years before, what you call 1453. But anyway, the point I'm making is the Sultan Mehmed, the conqueror, Al-Fatih, what took his army, this will surprise you in European history, from not Asia, from Europe. The headquarters of the Ottoman Empire had moved from Bursa to Edirne. Where is Edirne? Near the border of Greece and Bulgaria. The army came that way, leaving aside the fleet and the Bosphorus. So the point I'm making is that after 1453, there were famous battles like, I need to get my dates correct, like Varna, Nicopolis, and even if you dispute the dates, then the Ottomans from 1453 to 1683 got up to Vienna. So yes, there is rivalry between what you call Catholics and Protestants, but they were united, I would argue, against the Islamic conquests into Eastern Europe. which only got stopped in 1683 in Vienna. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm very surprised. I can't imagine Muslims in any way ruling Austria.
No. My point is that they failed twice to take Vienna. European history could have changed it that bad. They were meant to win. The army was massive, yeah? But they didn't. But that's another story. But the point, you'll say, why am I mentioning that? Well, I'm giving you a counter-argument. You don't have to agree with it. But I'm just giving you a counter-argument despite the divisions between Orthodox, yeah? Eastern Orthodox Christians and what you call Roman Catholics. I think at that time, it depends when the Protestant movement really took off. But at that time, they were united, as far as I know, to stop collectively the Muslim advance into Eastern Europe. How do you react to that? That is a fact.
Well, no, so they work together sometimes and they work against each other sometimes.
Well, yeah.
Know, this is very, very similar to, say, for example, the way that the West has been working with countries like Iraq. You know, they're our friends now, but then a few years later, no, they're our enemies and we're going to have to invade them, take them over. And you do sometimes get rulers that go native, if you want, and don't do what the empire wants them to do. But anyway, I think it's also useful to talk about some of the different traditions within Islam, and particularly the way it relates to the Ottoman Empire, which, for, you know, throughout later medieval period was extremely influential right up until the First World War, in fact. So what different traditions were there and who was kind of running that, and did it change over the centuries?
I think we need to do justice to America, if you don't mind, because it's very relevant. If I can just finish off what I was saying. So basically, the push to discover the Americas, I would say both Catholic and Protestant, yeah? Or the Anglo-Saxons and the Spaniards. Indeed, the Spaniards had a deep, I would argue, animosity to Islam that they took over from Spain into the Latin America and into Philippines, for instance. But coming to the point, so that was to circumnavigate the Muslim control over trade, commerce, which by definition means power. But then there is a second layer, I would argue. When the Americans eventually, and the Spaniards, but especially Americans, don't talk about America, after they did their ethnic cleansing or whatever, and genocide, and established their republic, what when? 1776, yeah? And when was the French? 1789. These are very important dates. I would argue, and we need to study this carefully, that the origins, I don't know about the French so much, but I've done some research on the American, yeah, Republic and its origins. This design of Washington and the promoters of the American Republic were Freemasons. So there is a, remember I mentioned satanic dimension, that depends on how you understand Freemasonry, leaving aside any anti-Islamic animus, is that the anti-Islamic, or Islamophobia if you want to call it, and Freemasonry merged at the foundation of the American Republic. And since it was on a mission of what? Conquest and power, and global power for that matter, manifest destiny, they did want to control the world, and that was the beginning of it, and we're still there. The Americans still have an empire, and it's in the Middle East, and it's using Israel as a Spartan fortress, which it sponsors and backs. So that's my answer to your, question about the American dislike for Islam. It's very deep-rooted.
Yeah, it does. Especially in these Masonic traditions, because many of these people are extremely powerful. They also don't tell you what their real motives are. This is the nature of Freemasonry. worth saying something about the third degree in Freemasonry, which is known as the most powerful of the initial rituals for people who join it, which includes a whole load of oaths where you swear to rebuild Solomon's temple. You're looking at Hiram Biff, who was in the Bible, was the guy who came over to build Solomon's temple. I mean, they are absolutely obsessed with the temple and with Solomon, but anybody who reads this, Jewish or Christian or Islamic, knows that Solomon was the king who went the wrong way. He started off very well, but then he got completely seduced by the Babylonian efforts and these bad people, basically, into all sorts of multiple wives, all this kind of thing, and utterly seduced away from the Ten Commandments and the original precepts. So Solomon is not a good, not a good example to follow, but they follow him. And also, well worth looking at the Mike Mandel and various other people who've pointed out by interviewing people who've been involved in witchcraft that these Masonic rituals are really just witchcraft rituals with a few extra bells and whistles put on them, and there's no mention of witchcraft. So this is essentially an ancient religious cult, and the Freemasonry, which emerged in London in the 1700s, has got lots of different aspects to it. But the main thing is that the Grand Orient Masonic lodges, which dominate Europe, are different to the United Grand Lodge in the UK, which is nominally a Christian organisation. Although, you see, this is one of the ways that the Freemasons have populated right the way through and taken over, essentially, the Anglican Church, is because they insist on Masons being put in as vicars, canons, and all certainly the senior leadership roles, where, for example, to the extent that you even got Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, openly becoming a druid. You know, this is how Christian he is. So it's obviously a tainted version of Christianity, a controlled version of Christianity. And actually, it's, I mean, if you really want to look into the depths of this witchcraft cult, Margaret Murray has written two excellent books. She was an anthropologist in the 1920s, 30s, up to the 50s, I believe. She wrote a book called The Witch Cult in Western Europe, and also another one called The God of the Witches, which explains basic stuff like the words we use, like the devil. In medieval times, the devil was the master of the coven, you know, the high priest of the coven. And it could be a man or a woman, but it was often a man. So lots of myths about witches being women are just nonsense. I mean, this is not part of that. But anyway, she did an extremely good, I think, and dispassionate look at the origins of witchcraft. And she doesn't really talk much about Freemasonry, but that's talked about by other people. And it's also quite important to understand with these secret societies that the Knights Templar basically became Freemasons. So when the Templars were extinguished by Philip the Fair in 1307, and I think it was the executions and the trial was a bit later, but they understood that in their secret meetings, the Templars were basically Satanists, and they were what happens is people say, oh, well, these confessions were extracted under torture. Well, there were several Templars who freely confessed to doing these things, and they were pardoned. They weren't tortured at all, but they understood that this was basically a satanic cult, which had been spawned by the Vatican. And of course, in order to sort of use that as a military force against the original church. But the other thing you said, which I think is so fascinating and new for me, really, is this idea that Islam and the Orthodox Church together, before the Orthodox, and it's still there, isn't it, the Orthodox Church in Russia and Greece, etc., had really prevented the Catholic Church, and later, after the mid-1500s, the 16th century, the Protestants, from expanding eastwards and trading eastwards. So this was a trading block. And like you say, there was another massive world, which the Phoenicians knew about, but no one else did. The Americas to the west, so they had to go that way. There was the only way to grow and expand. And in fact, this desperate need for expansion, constant expansion, taking over of other people's land is exactly what's going on right now with the Israelis into Gaza. And, of course, in other parts of the world where NATO is trying to expand to take over through the coup in 2014 and the European Union into Ukraine, right up to the borders of Russia, which the Russians don't want. You know, obviously, quite obviously, they're not going to allow that. The betrayal of the so-called perestroika, etc. So this is a big question, but it's also highly linked to these secret societies. And I wonder, because the most notorious secret society within Islam, Moeen, is these assassins. And we're seeing a lot of assassinations right now. Maybe the Western world has learned something from the Assassins Guild of, basically taking out the leaders. And we're seeing this all the time. We've even, just as we're speaking, heard about an attempt by the Israelis to assassinate Hamas leaders in Doha, in Qatar, who are doing the negotiating. And this has been happening, obviously, as people know, in Syria, with Hezbollah leaders, and this is happening all the time. The Western world is trying to kill leaders. Even the British, along with the Ukrainians, have killed several senior military officers in the Russian army, one in charge of chemical and biological weapons, for example, who was looking into and had exposed much of the chemical weapons and biological weapons development being done in Ukraine by Anthony Fauci and by the United States military that they were prevented from doing in the US. So, look, I mean, this is a bit of a long explanation, but I wonder what you make of the role of the Freemasons and other secret societies, and particularly maybe the Assassins, if you know anything much about them.
Thank you. Couple of points. Firstly, I won't go into detail, but very briefly, I take your point about Solomon, that the Christian tradition may have a different view. But from the Islamic tradition, we believe he was one of the prophets of, you know, we believe in one religion theory, if you want to call it. We believe he was, you know, an honourable prophet. Maybe not perfect, but we don't accept.
Well, this is the thing about Solomon. He was both. In his early life, he was fantastic and a brilliant ruler. But at the end of his life, he turned away from it.
Well, although Muslims and Christians and Jews believe a lot of similar things, there are different interpretations. I don't want to go into that, but Solomon is very significant in the Freemasonry, cult or occult, if you want to call it, but there are different interpretations. But coming back to assassinations, the first president of Pakistan, people forget, no wonder the military took over, was assassinated, the Yaqub Khan, when the East and West Pakistan was united when it had to solidify, consolidate, he was assassinated. So you're right, assassination has been used East and West. But you're right, there was the order. I remember one of my professors at Edinburgh University an expert on, and her husband, Professor Helen Brad, on art. But she was on Islamic history, and she knows a lot about the crusading period as an Arabist, and the assassins I came across in a long time in the 80s. But yes, the point I'm trying to make is the crusaders, they lasted, it wasn't just 1099 till 1187. There was at least 200 years, not 100, until they were totally kicked out. The point I'm making is they did learn a lot from the East, whether it's science, technology, things like food, even sugar, cotton, and what have you in science. But yes, they did also learn more about the sects of Islam, or heretics, dare I say. And one of them were the Ismaili. Technically, they're not Muslim, but there was a cult. And I'm sure they learned dark secrets on assassination from them. But coming, so that answers that. Now, coming to the role of Freemason and secret societies. Yes, the Europeans, Napoleon, I'm trying to look at the entry of the Europeans in the Islamic world. Some people take it to Napoleon's, what you call, rivalry with the British or English, and his attempted takeover of Egypt and Syria, which was repulsed by the British actually helping the Ottomans and Egyptians. Some people take the entry of the Europeans to that period, leaving aside the Russian Empire, you know, going into Central Asia. One can argue that different elites in the Islamic world were penetrated through Freemasonry, especially vis-a-vis the Ottoman Empire. But I think the rise and decline of Islamic civilization is like any civilization. You know, you have the birth, the rise and decline, you know, the cycle of civilization. So, because you must remember, you know, the Muslims were the masters and rulers of large, I wouldn't say the whole world, but large parts of the civilized world for a millennium, at least a millennium, from what? 7th, 8th century to 16th, 17th, if you want to call it, you know, a huge period. So a lot of the decline is to do with, you know, we got Islamic great scholars of history, sociology and civilization like Ibn Khaldun. The Westerners have Spengler and God knows who else. But I think the decline of any civilization is about the cycle of civilization. And I think the American one can give different perspectives. Also, in the decline now, the decline phase, you've had the rise.
Well, yeah, like the British, you know.
And the British, yeah.
So, it was quite funny, wasn't it? At the end of the Second World War, you had this almost like swap. It was like them passing the baton on to the next runner on the racetrack. The British just left many of these parts of the world, although they still obviously tried to control them. And the Americans militarily moved in, and then of course you've got also the IMF based in the United States using economic warfare against these places. So in a way that was just a sort of swapping over from the British yes. Americans.
However, what I would say, which I think is very important to share, is that you mentioned the role of Freemasonry and secret societies. I think because we've done a lot of work on money, when you look at the decline of a civilization, yeah, money is quite important. Other than decadence, luxury, decadence, the growing gap between rich and poor, is the corruption of money. For instance, definitely the Ottomans, with whatever reason one wants to describe, they were in debt. You could argue they were trapped into wars with Russia and other empires. So they were indebted. That's a different story. I don't want to go into that just now about Sheikh Imran Hussein's theory about Russia and the Ottomans. But basically, all empires, when they decline or they're at the decline phase, one can't just point the finger at the point I'm making to Freemasons and secret societies. Yes, they exist, but it's money, actually. And the reason I mention that is right now, the biggest enemy that the Americans have, guess who the biggest enemy the Americans have? The point I'm making is the money. Their fiat paper money is toilet money. Yeah. The debt they have is unpayable. All their enemy isn't China or the Global South or whatever. It's that. And all the Chinese need to do if they want the Americans to go down the tube is stop buying American treasuries, which is a debt, yeah, riba debt, interest-based usury, and buy gold. Goodbye, America. So the point is that when you have decline of civilization, I don't think we should be just blaming secret societies. It's actually the corruption of money. And debt.
Well, I suppose the idea is that it's about bribery, isn't it, really? This is the way that organised crime operates. It's also the way that massive governments operate. So they need to use all that money.
I mean, all I can say is a connection between money and secret societies, whether it's the, what you call, Bilderbergers, Freemasons or whatever, there is probably, I remember maths, you know, concentric circles, there is probably an overlap between them and the criminal banking mafia. The criminal banking cartel mafias, there is probably an overlap of some sort between the Masonic and whatever other secret societies you want to maybe identify.
Yeah, well, you're right, though, to talk about the way that money's evolved. In the United States, Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard because he needed to print extra money to fight the Vietnam War. And so a lot of this is to do with war. It's to do with expansionism, to do with violence, to do with death and killing. But I can remember years ago reading a fascinating little book about the ancient systems of money. I think it was a little tiny book, probably about 3 inches high and about 5-6 inches wide, a little hardback book all about the history of money. And one of the things it said right at the very start there was that the ancient Egyptians didn't have money. They had a system of credit where everybody, or the Egyptian pharaohs and their minions, kept records of what everybody was supposed to have in terms of just some digits on a page or a scroll or whatever. And then when you spent money, it was taken off. So this is a system of credit, all run centrally, but individuals didn't have anything at all of value. So over the years, of course, that's what's been going on since World War II. By taking the dollar off the gold standard, you can no longer redeem any of these notes for anything valuable. Yes. You have basically a token, and that token is in the faith of the administration that runs it. The Bank of England was made independent of the government by Gordon Brown. Back in the year roughly would be about 2006, I believe. Just before the 2008 crisis, the bailouts and everything. But by making the Bank of England independent, it wasn't independent of the government particularly, or the financial interests. It was independent of the people, because this is the Bank of England is now run specifically by the banking cartels. And it's not really, it shouldn't really be talked about as independent in any way. So that's just one example in London. And London, of course, is quite an important financial centre. The City of London is really run by guilds. And these are old medieval, it goes back a long way. These medieval guilds are livery companies. And they were used to control various trades. They were very... The Freemasons were one of them, so they were very insular. They had oaths of allegiance and this sort of thing, and rituals in order to be initiated and join these guilds. And so in London, you've still got the remnants of this very ancient system, even though those guilds no longer really have any relation to the trades that they're supposed to. They still sit there, and they still sit in control of the City of London, which is like a separate country. It's a bit like the Vatican. D.C., you know, separate to the surrounding arrangements. So I wonder, because there was, I know years ago, in the 1990s and early noughties, something called the Christian Council for Monetary Justice in London.
Yes.
People like Sabine McNeil and various others. I don't know if you... Because I don't know that there is any real organisation in the UK, certainly, but maybe there is elsewhere, that really looks at these big questions about money and whether individuals in a country have actually got anything of value, or whether this is just some sort of ledger that that's the government or a private company keeps, and they can just control them, control people, and they can just strike people off of the register if they feel like it, and then all the money that people have saved disappears.
Yes, monetary reform. Dr. Simon Mowat, who teaches political economy, he was linked to that. Indeed, Pete Cannon, Peter Challen, still alive in his 80s. But I don't know whether they're active. There may be other monetary reform movements. But coming back to your point on money and the decline of the American empire, is that there were, firstly, positively, there are solutions to it. All debt should be cancelled. That was part of, especially Christian, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, to cancel debt. But secondly, definitely money should not be treated as a commodity. You know, the usury should be criminalised, because the bottom line is controlled by a banking criminal mafia. And but from an Islamic angle, our currency or Islamic monetary theory, or my interpretation, is we've always had the golden dinar, or a gold, or if you don't want to talk about a golden physical dinar, a gold-backed currency. So the, I think all of that is very vital, important for, what's the word, stability in global finance, leaving aside getting rid of corruption, which is everywhere. Corruption is everywhere. And criminal cartels and mafias controlling countries, but the money control needs to be sorted out. But coming back to the Middle East and global power, there is another theory about what's happening in the world right now, about global control of the world, basically. There's always a contest between good and evil, as I mentioned from Adam to now, is that you could argue, and I'm picking up on your point, that there are three cities, I'm going to add four just now, there are three cities that control the world. One is the city of London, as you've defined, I've studied that too. The city of London Square Mile, which controls money, which was passed from Venice to Amsterdam to London. So that still has a key role in global finance. Secondly is military power. That is controlled by a square mile. I mentioned the Freemasonic origins of 1776, but the Potomac, you know, the military, okay, it's political, but it's also military control of the world through the American, not republic, empire. There is an empire. You've got 800 military bases, for instance, in the world. China only has one in Djibouti. So that's two cities, right? Square, they're all square miles. City of London, Potomac, Washington. Which one is the third one? Instead of me doing all the talking, which one do you think is the third one?
Oh, gosh. No, come on. I'm sorry. You have to tell me.
It's a square mile. The Vatican has always had an ambition to control the spiritual or religious legions of mankind. So that's three. So that's USA. You mentioned, you know, the dislike of them to Islam, because Islam is a rival. It's not because they're intrinsically, you know, anti-Muslim. It's about power. Is it power of God that rules the world, God's sovereignty, or Freemasonic secular sovereignty and satanic sovereignty? So you've got three cities, the Vatican, the city of London, the Potomac, Washington, as Italy, Britain, US. Now, I said there's a fourth one. These three, what you call nodes in global control, are the forces behind wanting Jerusalem to be, whatever you want to call it, yeah, the capital of the world. So, at all, by all means, at any means, they want to be rooted and have their people, whoever they are, whether it's Zion, Nazis or whatever, they want to control that area. And that's what's happening right now, because they want to prepare to control the whole world via... So they will have a new, they will have a global capital, not just a Jewish capital, which will control the world. And then you need an emperor. An emperor, you know, you don't just need a capital; you need an emperor. They want to install some. I would call them a satanic, djalic ruler, but they want to install their so-called ruler, or you might call him Antichrist. I rest my case.
Well, you're right about Vatican, because we had just literally this week, or last week, we're talking about in September 2025, the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, visiting the new pope. So Pope Francis, who was a pope before, who died, he was pro-Palestinian. He made lots of statements about Palestine. But the new pope, who I think is Leo, another one of these Leos, this guy is welcoming the genocidalist in chief of the entire world into the Vatican for a little chit chat. Now, I don't think anybody can be under any illusions that the Pope is trying to persuade this chap to be a nice person and stop killing tens of thousands of children. What's going on here is the Israelis are using the Vatican and the Pope as a public relations stunt in order to try and legitimise. But what you're saying is that you think that the Vatican may be part of trying to install a confidence in a New World Order style government based in Jerusalem.
Well, I've come across various geopolitical thinkers. I think we need to maybe engage with them. People like a guy called Canadian Patriot called Matt Errett, because he really goes into all of this stuff very, very deep, right? He's like a parrot. He can, he can connect the dots. Maybe not all of them. And maybe some of the things we're talking about, he's not gone that far about, you know, the Antichrist or the Mahdi, etc., where this is culminating, the clash between good and evil, and Jesus, for that matter. But he's very deep at connecting the dots. The point is that what you've just said, the alliance, you know, this thing about the Judeo-Christian so-called alliance, yeah? And the support for Sparta, a Spartan Israel of Zionazi genociders. I mean, it's very complex to unravel, but I've just argued that I believe there is a connection between the military, financial, and the Vatican, however you want to conceptualize spiritual, religious, whatever, nexus, and Jerusalem. Because to understand why a genocide has been allowed, basically that's the sum of the last 2 years over Gaza and Palestine, there are things that are not being spoken about. I mean, what I'm trying to say is you can't just blame European guilt for the Holocaust on the support for the current Zionist regime. There's something much sinister and deeper going on. But ultimately, it's about the control of the world. They're using deception. They're using their power and control to control the whole world. And for that, you need a capital and you need an emperor of some sort. And the only new thing I want to say is the other new force or trick that they're using is transhumanism and technocracy. I'm not talking about technology. Some experts make a distinction between technology and what is called technocracy and transhumanism, some sort of immortality, religion of immortality. I think that is something new in their control, tactics or strategy of the world.
This idea that that there is some much bigger plan going on, it's not just about Gaza. I mean, this strikes me from a journalistic point of view. What we're seeing immense amounts of at the moment is this whole concept of accusations by the Israelis actually being confessions. So when they accuse someone else of doing something, it's actually what they're doing. So when they say, for example, that Arab countries are trying to wipe Israel off the map, actually what they're doing is they're trying to wipe these other countries off the map. countries like Syria, Libya. In fact, that's exactly what they're doing. At the moment in Lebanon, for example, we've got this big split between the army and Hezbollah. So this is what the Israelis and the Americans are up to. They're dividing and ruling, just like the British Empire and the Romans before them.
Yes.
And so there's a lot of this sort of thing going on. But in terms of focusing a new kind of new government, new world order in Jerusalem, the British at the moment, and of course the United States, are in a very big way supporting what's going on. In fact, we've had the Epstein files just being released, where you can see that there's this very powerful Mossad operation been going on with Ghislaine Maxwell at the heart of it, who were getting politicians, compromising them, getting compromat on them with underage kids, or even with Prince Andrew, an overage girl. The idea is that this is then used to blackmail individuals. So this was a very important high-level operation. It looks like Trump may well have been sucked into that too. And the idea is that all of these people, once they've got the compromat, are then propelled, using their influence in the press and the media and within the apparatchiks of political parties, to propel them to positions of high power and authority, and then to say to them, well, unless you do what the Israelis want you to do, then you're going to be outed in the press, etc. So there is this massive operation going on. In the UK, I think it's even more shocking to see that the organisation Palestine Action, which is a non-violent direct action group, which is trying to stop the genocide. In fact, people who are part of that, the protests about this proscription, such as Angie Zelter, I knew from the 1990s, that she was actually acquitted by the High Court, even though she'd been into an airbase and she'd destroyed a Hawk jet which was being sent to Indonesia because she was stopping a greater crime. Now, it now seems that in London, if you're supporting genocide, so, for example, if you're saying, I agree with Netanyahu's tactics for killing tens of thousands of people, and you pick up a megaphone and you say that, or you have a sign, or you do a broadcast or a podcast saying that, you're fine. But if you support a non-violent group that's trying to stop genocide, you're not fine. So this is what I'm saying, Moeen, is that this isn't just obviously about Jerusalem and Israel. It's very much about the extended support networks in Britain and America too.
Well, yes. I mean, the it's multi-layered, complex. What's the word? Relationship. I'm just looking at the WhatsApp. Yeah, you're right. Right now, today is what, Wednesday, September 10th. What is the real reason Starmer is meeting Herzog in number 10? So that's something to think about. Yeah.
On the 11th of September.
No. Today is the 10th.
Yeah, I understood that Herzog was coming to the UK after he's been to see the Pope. He's coming to the UK tomorrow on the 11th.
Well, I'm looking at the BBC news right now. It may have changed, but it says here that he's coming on Wednesday to London.
Well, maybe he's already there. But anyway, the point is that you've got a red carpet rolled out for these people who are the biggest war criminals, some of the biggest that the world has ever seen. I remember also very well reading a book called The Seventh Seal by Dennis Wheatley. Wheatley was a fantastic historical novelist who's now been completely buried, cancelled, and there's an attempt to get him forgotten, even though he was a brilliant best-selling author in the 1950s, 60s and 70s. And his book called The Seventh Seal was all about this soldier who gets wind of the attempt to start World War One, and he's travelling all around Europe trying to stop the beginning of the First World War. But what he does during the novel, his historical novel, is to talk in great detail about all of the horrific things which were put in place to deliberately start the First World War. And he realised that things like that were deliberate. And in fact, he was brought in during the Second World War into Churchill's cabinet, the war cabinet, where the war was being directed from. as a deception planner, what we would now call a psychological warfare officer. And he was one of the people who was absolutely instrumental in misdirecting the Nazis to believe that D-Day invasion of the continent of Europe by the British and the Americans and others and Canadians, etc., was going to take place in Calais, to such an extent that something like 6 or 7 divisions of the Germans were pinned down in Calais waiting for an invasion that never came, instead of actually moving over to Normandy, which is where the invasions were actually happening.
Yes.
The sort of guy Wheatley was, and he also wrote a fascinating book called The Devil and All His Works, where he says a few things. He says, for example, that he believed that Adolf Hitler was a prototype for the Antichrist to come in the future, this idea of a man-god,
yes,
a cult surrounding the SS, surrounding Hitler from Wevelsburg Castle, which is where they were based, a really kind of high black magic witchcraft cult. The idea is to protect a human who is going to do whatever they want. You know, so that was Adolf Hitler, the prototype of the coming Antichrist in the future, prophesied in Islam called the Dajjal, and in Christianity under the name the Antichrist. So what I'm saying is these world wars are planned, have been planned, it seems to me. In fact, if you go back to, who by? The question would be who by? Well, obviously the royal families of Europe, who are all interconnected. The First World War was something which was basically a family squabble between the Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany, George V in London, and Tsar Nicholas in Russia. They were all cousins, and you could just call it the Cousins' War, as some people do. But it expressed itself in this horrific mass slaughter. And also, of course, the sideline, you might say it was the main object of the First World War, which was to sweep the Ottoman Empire out of Palestine. But what I'm trying to say was the Anthony Blunt, who was the fourth man, if you remember the Cambridge spy ring.
Yes.
The Cambridge spies were Burgess, Maclean, Philby, who all tried to get over to the Soviet Union. I think they all ended up there escaping. And then there was Anthony Blunt, who was pardoned and forgiven, amazingly, because what I've heard from Ronan Perry, the Australian writer, who's written a whole book about Victor Rothschild and about many of these subjects. He's a terrific writer, actually.
Yes.
And Roland said, oh, well, Anthony Blunt was an illegitimate son of George V. And so that's why he was given protection by the royal family. And he was used for intelligence purposes. I mean, officially, he was keeper of the Queen's pictures, but he was actually unofficially working as an intelligence. But anyway, so at the end of the Second World War, Blunt was sent over to Germany to the castle, which was the family of the Kaiser, was still living. And there was all these messages and letters from Queen Victoria's people to the Germans, right the way back to the 1880s, were being kept in this castle. So Anthony Blunt was sent over there literally a few days after the end of World War II to go and grab all these letters and bring them back to Windsor Castle, because they realised if they got out, then they might find that these royals had been plotting the First World War and the Second World War and possibly a Third World War. The royal family was really at the heart, or that this extended royal family around Europe, the Europeans, were at the heart. And you do wonder, don't you, looking at the situation now with America, if these European royal aristocracy, at the very top of the aristocracy, I'm not talking about all aristocrats by any means, but that they were the ones who are now pushing this United States of Europe, which is this political union, a completely undemocratic, anti-democratic system where they just appoint people like the foreign minister of Europe and to pursue a third world war against Russia. That's the only way. What I suppose I'm saying is that it looks to me as if the European aristocracy, Moeen, have been at the heart of a lot of this, death and destruction. And yet they still seem to be, through the public relations, through King Charles and Queen Camilla, the murderer of his wife, Princess Diana, although he didn't actually do the deed. It's quite obvious and clear that he was involved in sanctioning the murder of Diana in Paris. And that is obviously not going to go down too well for his karma. These people, it seems that the European aristocracy still play a very important role in all of this that people often forget.
Yes, I would agree with you. I know you've done a lot of work on Bilderbergers. My final view is this, just to blend with your thinking, but take it to its logical conclusion and eschatology. I think the World War III, which some experts claim is already started, is really to prepare Jerusalem, some sort of united city and united Israel, to welcome the world Führer or world leader or Dajjal, as we called him. And that's, you could actually interpret these so-called world wars as stages by this occult or these criminal satanic mafias. World War One led to the demise of the Ottomans and the Balfour Declaration, 1917. It paved the way, and the mandates. World War Two, including Hitler and the Holocaust, created the pressure for a Jewish state. 1948. I think the Third World War, there is an agenda. That's why, you know, how on earth after 2 years has the state of Israel still got immunity to do this, that and the other, genocide and expansionism, you know, this greater Israel. I think they won a world war to make Israel the new, as Imran Hussein quite articulates quite sharply, as a new world ruling state or empire. And for that, they don't just want Israel, you know, the Palestine occupied territories, they want a bigger area, you know, from the Nile to the Euphrates. Basically, what that means is a bigger area, living space and resources and control of, you know, trade routes, etc. So I think the decision to have some sort of a world conflagration, and it's so easy to arrange. There are various flashpoints in the world, from Taiwan, Korea, Pakistan, India, border, Middle East, Ukraine, and Europe. I think that's where we're at. And that's why maybe I think we need another Global Vision Eschatology seminar in December. And
well, yeah, I mean, people are certainly waking up, Maureen. I think, you know, more people becoming aware. It's not as even as if the perpetrators really put too much of an effort to keep these things secret. It's just that as things start to emerge, truth starts to emerge in different ways. It's, you know, very much, if you look at the September the 11th attack, for example, when it started to become clear through the journals of the people who do controlled demolition, etc., that is it, Danny Jewenko, I think there were several of the people.
Yeah, yes.
This. So then this new theory came out, which was, the aircraft are holograms and they never even hit the Twin Towers. Well, the idea, of course, is, you know, to just completely divert discussion away. So we see exactly the same thing going on. You know, this is the world press. This is psychological warfare. The whole world's press is just sent in the wrong direction. And then we had exactly the same thing, you know, multiple different events. So, for example, with COVID-19, as the evidence started coming out about the Wuhan lab, the funding by Fauci of the development of this gain-of-function research there, the involvement of Peter Daszak and Eco Health Alliance and various other organisations, as that started to emerge, so another theory came out through David Icke and others, which is designed to completely divert it, which is that there is no such thing as a virus and that this is a complete fiction. So this stuff is pushed out very powerfully across the world by loads of different controlled opposition organizations in order to completely distract everyone's attention from these things as they happen. And the other thing I'd say, I mean, we should finally have a bit more of a little chat about the comparative eschatology between Islam and Christianity, because my understanding really is based on the King James Bible, pretty much, and the Book of Revelation is very clear. I mean, I believe that, and many people do over the centuries, of course, that it was the gospel writer John that wrote Revelation when he was exiled to Patmos in one of the Greek islands. And in fact, if you go to Patmos now, you can still see the little church which was set up after Revelation was printed or written and scrolled by this guy called Procurus. So John spoke the words that of the vision he saw from the island, and this guy Procurus scribbled it all down, and that managed to find its way into our modern Bible. But it's pretty clear that there will be these four horsemen of the apocalypse. This is a warning to everybody. So when these events take place, metaphorically spoken about as these horsemen, so the white, for the person in white who comes out as a great leader, then you get the red horse, which is war, a massive war of some kind, and then you get the black horse, which is economic disaster, and then you get the pale horse, which is famine, and absolute, you know, people basically dying of disease, starvation. And these are the events which are talked about in Revelation. You also get characters like the two witnesses, these people who speak up for God, who manage to do so right around the world, and everyone is able to see and watch them, and explain to everybody pretty much what's going on, the deception, through the deception. But anyway, these two very important figures, the Antichrist and the false prophet. Now, I remember Trump's doctor, I can't remember his name right now, but anyway, he was a Jewish guy. Maybe you can remember it. He was talking about Yuval Noah Harari as a false prophet. This is the way that many rabbinic-type European Jews that Hitler tried to exterminate will talk about these events, because they understand it very well, which is why Hitler wanted to get rid of them all. And so that's the false prophet talked about, which is a kind of spiritual leader. He's just a deceiver, but he will con many people. And then of course, the Antichrist, who is talked about in Islam as the Dajjal. And this is someone who comes into a chaotic situation, a terrible war with millions of people dying, and then they bring peace. But the thing is that they are part of the game that has created the war in the first place. A little bit like Adolf Hitler saying to Europe, yeah, you know, we can have peace now if you do as I say. Yeah, so these figures are quite important, but the only way that the Antichrist can succeed and come along is if you have that chaos beforehand. And there's a lot of people who have pointed out that Netanyahu is he follows this guy Rambam from who's one of the rabbis who wrote in, I think it was in the 11th or no 13th century maybe in Egypt, and he talks about this guy who's the king who will bring in the Jewish Messiah. So all the people that deny Christ as the Messiah in Judaism, and there's many of them who are now doubting whether it's right to deny Christ as the Messiah, will embrace this Antichrist as as a Jewish Messiah, and that will happen in the future. But that cannot happen without somebody like Netanyahu as a king of chaos to come along and create the situation, which is like the red carpet. In a way, you know, you go back to World War II and World War I, the Treaty of Versailles was a red carpet for Hitler, because the economic devastation that was deliberately meted out to the whole of Germany after the First World War created a brilliant situation for somebody like Hitler to come along, and everyone would say, oh, what a great guy, he's starting to sort the country out. So these economic miseries it seems to me, are not just about people being greedy for money, but they're also about creating the social conditions whereby some kind of messiah can be seen to be a great person who's coming over the horizon. So I wonder if you could maybe take some of that or none of that into consideration and talk about the way that Islamic eschatology sees these things developing and some of the creatures and characters in the saga.
Well, yes. I mean, as I said, there's one religion, basically the same religion, to believe in God. All prophets, 124,000, were you know, teaching humanity. So there are basically similarities to the Christian view. I think definitely the Malhama and the chaos, Malhama meaning the great war or a series of wars, I think they've started, as I mentioned, World War III, you know, what's happening in Ukraine. The latest I've heard is there is real tension brewing on the expansion of the war, NATO war, with Poland and Belarus. And obviously Netanyahu has struck at one of the Gulf states using whatever pretext and Hamas in Qatar. So yes, I think I probably agree with you about Netanyahu. The very fact he is called Baby, you know, it's like a nickname of affection by the global media and politicians, says a lot. You know, why don't they call them something else, you know? But basically, certainly he has got the occult cabal, criminal global cabal behind him, and who've let him, do what he wants with immunity. He's certainly causing, basically what I'm saying is chaos is certainly when the Mahdi, I mean, they have their plans. As the Quran says, they plan, but Allah plans. And Allah is the best plotter. So yes, there is a game in town, a global game, a global plot. But the Quran says Allah is the best of planners. So the context will be chaos and war. And then the counter forces of good will appear, like the Mahdi. The latest information I put on my website is that the Sufi Brotherhood, you know, the Sufi orders are massive in Islamic civilization globally. You know, people talk about Sunni and Shia, but the Sufis, the mystical dimension. One of their leaders in Canada, Vancouver, I think, has declared the Mahdi is here. But Imam Mahdi, meaning the rightly guided Imam Mahdi, who will take on the Dajjal with Isa, but also he's more involved in the wars, or the chaotic period, the war period. He claimed, I put that on the website, I will maybe pontificate on it a bit more, but he's claiming that the Mahdi was born in 73, in where I am. I'm not saying Istanbul, but in Turkey. But as a child, he was, for his protection, or a baby, or as a child, taken to Arabia, where he is guided by angels and jinn. But he's not manifested himself. There's a distinction between birth and manifestation. As he will appear, that's why I believe in, what did I say, the domino theory in eschatology. You know, the right conditions, he will appear and, you know, coming at the right time. And secondly, the second thing I would add to that, although it's not, orthodox thinking, but we recently, there's a video I'm going to put up. You know the blood moon we had? Do you follow? There was a lunar moon recently, yeah? According to some Muslim astrologists, they said that, I think, I'm using your term, acceleration. They used the term that various chaotic things are going to accelerate. And they mentioned things like governments falling, famine, because it's linked to September, Pisces, the next 6 months, water, meaning flood, floods, famine, wars, global instability is going to accelerate after the, what you call, the lunar moon. So anyway, and then you got Netanyahu creating havoc. So I think we have entered a period of chaos. Mm. But yes, they have their plan, but Allah says he is the best of planners. So we have to watch and witness very intensely, as I am, and I'm not sure like you, what's happening. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And of course, the point of Freemasonry infiltrating, say, the Anglican Church, for example, is that the inaction of these people and the lack of speaking out by them and their non-adherence to the faith, of course, is a blow to people's faith. This is the point of it. The idea is that people put their faith in not so much necessarily in Christ or Allah or the Quran or the Bible, but in the institutions. And as those institutions fail, those infiltrated institutions fail to do their job. In fact, sometimes they may well be applauding the people who are the forces of darkness. So this is a way to really, like, destroy souls. That's part of the battle that's going on. But look, as part of all of this, I cannot fail to mention this chap, Peter Thiel, because he's a very influential guy. He's extremely, you know, with his PayPal company and his financing of Facebook and various other social media, very, very influential, with his own little bolt hole in Queenstown in New Zealand, where he's built himself, found himself, where the world that he controls in many ways and influences immensely turns to death and war, etc. He can go get over in his private jet and be happy in the South Island of New Zealand. He's been talking about the Book of Revelation. He's been talking about the end of the world. And I suppose this might be a little bit like the accusations made by Netanyahu that people want to get rid of the State of Israel, which obviously now they do more after his actions, not less. Whereas actually it's him that wants to destroy the others. So he now is talking about the end of the world, and he seems to think that he is one of the only people in the world who really gets it, even though it seems to me maybe that he's just trying to control that narrative to put people off the scent. What do you think? Why is Thiel so interested in the end?
I am studying him. The more I look at it through Technocracy website, Patrick Woods, I'd like him to speak. It's clear that he's connected to Musk, from what I can gather, and some argue Epstein, although Epstein has been linked to agendas and blackmail. Epstein, Musk, Thiel, dare I say, Gates, but I think it needs more research. All I can say is that they are. The point I'm making is World War III. We're at the chaotic period, right? Then you've got the Malhama, World War III. However, in terms of their plot, right, they've got, you know, Jerusalem earmarked as their capital, and Israel, or the Israel Empire, or Eretz Israel as their empire for the region. However, they also have an ideology and and religion. And I think I've hinted at this before, that although religions, or even races for that matter, are being put at each other's throats, all over the world, whether it's racial war, ethnic war or religious war, they are creating a new religion. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is that this new technocracy and, what was the other word, technocracy and transhumanism. Yeah? Is the new religion. So I think we got off who? Off the Antichrist. So that we need to contextualize people like Thiel as missionaries or ambassadors. It's interesting, the location of this is Silicon Valley. Of some of these tools and mechanisms. Just to clarify, I mentioned lunar moon. I should have said lunar eclipse. So this recent lunar eclipse that happened, some experts on the significance mentioned the acceleration of chaos, whether it's environmental disasters or the fall of governments. Is it not interesting, as we speak, or indeed after the eclipse, another government is almost falling in Nepal, yeah? And where else was there? Other places, yeah? So I think, France for that matter, yeah?
Interesting. Well, that's right. I mean, actually, lots of governments around the world are kind of on the brink, aren't they?
Yeah.
Too much to push. Thailand is another one. You know, these countries are pretty fragile in terms of their stability. They're not stable. And, of course, it's largely the political parties, the infiltrated parties, and the money system, the international trade system, big organisations around security like NATO, for example, who have been destabilising those individual countries. So, yeah, it looks like we're moving towards a kind of maybe a more chaotic. Yeah, so fascinating insights.
Well, Pakistan and India with their floods, leaving aside whether it was, geoengineering or climate change, these are the breadbaskets, you know, Punjab, both on the Indian side and Pakistan. It's a disaster, the breadbasket. So that's going to lead to not just economic tensions, yeah, prices, inflation, but maybe political. So that I think that those areas have been destabilized too with the current flood. So yeah, I think acceleration post eclipse, which is very recent, is happening. The point I'm trying to make is people are not really, in general, viewing current affairs from a holistic or spiritual angle. If you understand what I'm saying.
Seems to be so utterly lacking. I mean, we still haven't mentioned China. China's a very interesting country. Chairman Mao was actually sent into China after plenty of money had been given to him. He was coached in book writing. There's a very good documentary about him. I think it was put out by PBS in the United States in the history of China. And he was funded by Yale University back in around about the time of the First World War, and his bookshops were also funded by them, and many of his books were printed in Chinese, obviously, and circulated before the revolution. So this was basically a skull and bones project to create modern China. Then, of course, you've got the modern Xi Jinping, which is an atheist state. The idea, of course, is that there is no God officially except President Xi. And in fact, this is again a bit of a Hitlerian man God style character. What's he doing? He's expanding, but you know, he's doing nothing about Palestine. I find this extraordinary, really, that although China has a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, they could be doing all sorts of things. They could be really pushing diplomatically for the Americans and everyone else to, and the Russians, etc., to have unanimity. They could be putting forward resolution against resolution, which the Americans might veto, but they're not doing any of that. They could be proposing peacekeeping forces, military action. They've got a massive military. They've just been demonstrating it at the Shanghai Organization Summit. They're doing absolutely nothing, are they?
Well, that's a fascinating topic you've raised. The rise of, I mentioned the rise and fall of civilizations, the rise of China. You're right, it's got an atheistic communist dimension. From an Islamic perspective, the Muslim world, not all the Arab states, as far as I know, didn't attend the victory parade or the SEO. But interestingly, I mentioned this to someone else, non-Arab Muslim states did attend the, if you want to call it, the Chinese axis, yeah? For instance, Iran was there at the president or prime minister level. Pakistan, Iran, Turkey, Erdogan, and the Central Asian Muslim republics, and also even Indonesia and Malaysia. Now, that is very interesting. The Muslim world seems to be either in the Anglo-American Western camp, like the Arabs in particular, but it seems as though other non-Arab Muslim states are going under the, what you call, Beijing, maybe Russian banner, or not banner, but umbrella. But I think you're right. I think from an eschatological angle, the fate of the disbelievers, by that I mean atheists in particular, there's a big question mark, because the coming kingdom, the coming era, or the future era after the chaos, is the kingdom of God. Interestingly, having said that, I want to make one point. I came across a video series very recently, which was very interesting. It was about a channel or a website or videos which are looking at how nation states, to use a political term, will break up if they collapse. Now, I think this is very interesting. We haven't even talked about it. You know, the UK as a territorial nation state, you know, you've got Scotland, England, Ireland, Wales and Channel Islands, etc. Now, they're looking at what would happen to current nation states globally. You know, how would they naturally, what's the word, coalesce if the central regime and state collapsed? Now, I think that is very interesting for a king. No one's really talked about it in terms of a post-chaotic kingdom of God world. I think the organization of humanity is going to be very, very different, as opposed to being centralized, regimented, etc., etc. So that's another thought for the day.
Well, yeah, I mean, that, you're absolutely right about the United Kingdom. It's no longer really very united, because powers have been devolved to Northern Ireland, to Scotland and to Wales. And in fact, you know, life is really quite different in these places. The way it's worked is this is all something which was started by Tony Blair and the European Union back in the late 1990s and early noughties, the idea of devolution. And of course, this is part of the pan-European project, pan-European Union based in Munich, the Nazi party based in Munich, and the United States of Europe, now an unelected fascistic dictatorship, very much like the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft documents issued by the Nazi government in 1941 about how they wanted to run occupied Europe, and in many ways they did run occupied Europe before it was liberated by the Allies. What with these areas, Wales and Scotland exactly, they're not part of one country, they're just regions of a European unelected fascist superstate. That seems to be the way that they wanted. And of course, these sorts of countries are extremely fragile. The leadership is there because they are appointed. And so, of course, whoever does the appointing can then just get rid of people whenever they want to. We've seen, it's worth mentioning, we've seen over the last week or so, the departure of Angela Rayner, who's not only the Deputy Prime Minister, she's also the elected Deputy Leader of the Labour Party. So she has resigned from those roles. She's been forced to resign, no doubt been bribed to resign, over some bad advice she got from her solicitor, possibly a solicitor's sting operation, very easy to do that sort of thing, and been replaced by two Bilderbergers. So David Lammy is the current person who's replaced her. If there is an election within the Labour Party, Wes Streeting is the favourite. He's also a Bilderberger. But Angela Rayner is not in the club. So this is the way that leaderships are decided nowadays, and there's absolutely no discussion from the press whatsoever about the fact that these people have just been put in place by a Bilderberg organisation. There's no discussion about that. So I think you're quite right about the destabilisation of Britain. It's something that I think the Queen was a little bit perturbed about, but we're now really in the United Kingdom is not really, you know. Okay, so there's no checks on the borders yet as you cross them, but then of course they wouldn't be if it was all part of one unelected fascist superstate. You know, what you do is you just put the border checks in when it suits you and you take them out, because you can do that sort of thing as a fascist. Anyway, I think would you like to just say something to sum up? Because we have the only other aspect of this I don't think we've really mentioned at all is the Russians and their role.
Yes, I mean, for a third world war situation like the Second World War, you've got to have two blocks, yeah? Them and us. So that is shaping up. But from an eschatological angle, I know Imran Hussein wants Muslims to basically be in bed with Russia, but I think that needs a much deeper discussion, because he's quoting Quran or his interpretation. But I think that we've got to contextualize the battle lines between good and, you know, truth, the forces of good, justice, versus the forces of deception, falsehood, injustice, and oppression. And whether it's Russia or China or America or Europe, doesn't matter. We got to somehow have an equation for end times that doesn't really, what's the word, fall into a trap, yeah? Well, what I'm trying to say is the coming polar prototypes, spiritual prototypes, will be the Mahdi, Imam Mahdi, and his army, and the Dajjalic forces. These are the two poles that the world's going to be divided into. I think where Russia, China, etc., and NATO, Anglo-Americans, etc., fall in is to do with a war. But the real, what I'm trying to say is, yeah, there's going to be a big war. I mean, it started. But the real war, if that's what I'm trying to say, is going to be a spiritual war. So somehow we've got to address these two equations, if that makes sense. And maybe we should look at that in the December 14th Global Vision, and you'd be pleased to invite you as a key speaker. Indeed, I think maybe we should divide the day into two sections. One is the eschatology of justice, about what I'm talking about, and the eschatologies of peace.
There is no justice in Britain, certainly at the top level. What you've got is you've got the, as I was saying, the Israeli president being welcomed into London, whereas an Irish comedian, Graham Linehan, he comes to London with a joke about trans people and he is arrested at gunpoint by five armed police officers. So there's obviously something very unjust going on in the UK. And I think also we ought to just leave people with, you know, the listeners with some thoughts about, thank you for bearing with us, it's quite a long discussion we've been having here, but some thoughts about, you know, what to do, where to go, and particularly where to find people who've got their heads around some of this. So rather than just leave people, it might be useful to mention a few individuals, books, websites, etc., where you can find some people who are making sense of all this.
I must confess, I don't recommend anyone, really, including myself. I mean, that's why our website, yeah, we have thousands of videos. I think various experts from different disciplines, whether religion, politics, economics, current affairs, I select those who I think are wise and who are on the ball, and who can contextualize the discussion. So I don't have one, actually. If you go to the globalvision2000.com forum, we have different electronic threads, which are really video books or electronic books, but I don't tend to just focus on one expert. Not really. Also, I know a couple of languages, Urdu in particular. I can access Indian and Pakistani thinkers, so that's not going to help English speakers. No, as I said, wherever you can get hold of some of them if they dub the videos. I mean, obviously one can be tempted to refer to people like Imran Hussein and others, but no, I mean, I don't really want to recommend any particular individual.
That's absolutely fine. I would recommend him as a sort of person to get in, Imran Hussein, to get into some of these topics, because he's quite an entertaining speaker. He's quite lighthearted. And another, of course, is someone I interview regularly. That's David Livingstone. He's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. He's also the author of a tremendous book called The Dying God, which does, in a way, a little bit what Margaret Murray was doing in her books, The God of the Witches and The Witch Cult in Western Europe, which is to join the dots of history, to go back and look at, you know, because I think we're talking about two completely different worldviews and various other worldviews, but two main ones. One is the Eastern view that you have, which is, you could just see as Hindu, but it's also pagan, from Britain in years gone by, prehistoric times, which is this dualism, the idea that that the good versus evil, that they don't think like that at all. It's harmony. You have to have good, you have to have evil, and that the two just have to balance, and that's the way things are. This is sort of talked about as yin-yang, and it's there in Hinduism. You have a pantheon of gods, various different gods, the good gods, the bad gods, and you choose your god. That's their way. But, I mean, we think very differently to that. We're more like sheep and goats people, so the world is divided into good and evil of various sorts, and the various different denominations, like, for example, Protestant, Catholic, Shia, Sunni, even so far as some of the more mystical aspects of Christianity, or you could even start talking about the Gnostics, although they're pretty strange a lot, that they are either doing public spirited work that they're honest about, and they're correct and they're true, and they're there thinking public spirited thoughts, or else they're just deceivers, you know. So it's one or the other. It's not much in between, really, from a Judeo-Christian point of view. So I think it's important to say that this, you know, this whole business of I think it was, wasn't it called The Golden Dawn of Aleister Crowley, is quite important to recognise.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, all I can say is that on our website we have various experts that we upload and put up with our own commentary. But, okay, I'll give you one which will surprise you. I think at a time of chaos, as we've said, yeah, chaos, an acceleration of time and chaos, people need faith, or let's call it hope, and obviously guidance. I think the Sufi dimension, which we haven't discussed, the mystical dimension of Islam, which is very powerful, there is a thread that's reached, over a million. It's got over a million hits now. It's the Naqshbandi order. He's from the Naqshbandi, which is a famous Orthodox Sunni Sufi group, but they're seen as some sort of pillar for all Sufi groups. They have a lot of English medium videos on the spiritual dimension to the world. And the language they use, you know, is universal. It's also in English. So that's worth looking at. Sheikh, what's his name? Mirabad, I think it is, yeah. So it's on our website under the thread called Islamic Spiritual Enlightenment, in which I've put up his videos. I think the spiritual dimension, it's okay talking about politics, wars, etc., etc., chaos. But I think people need hope. They need a new. They need also to tie their hands to the rope at a time of storms, spiritually speaking, spiritual storms and chaos. And I think the spiritual or Islamic Sufi dimension perspectives is quite important.
Yeah, so grab the rope and don't let go. That's the idea.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But make sure it's the right rope first, so do your homework.
Yeah, yes.
So, you know, I was talking about the difference between East and Western faiths, and these two, this is one of the, I think, key, absolutely key differences that people don't necessarily grasp these days and never gets talked about in the mainstream press, is to do with this whole... I mean, if you look at Aleister Crowley, he was a self-confessed Satanist. He was... he called himself the Prince of Darkness, the Antichrist, this sort of thing. So he wasn't making any bones about it. But he was very clear in creating this organisation called the Golden Dawn, which interesting people were members of, many interesting people, Yeats. But for me, one of the most fascinating of his members was this guy, Sax Rohmer. Sax Rohmer wrote the Fu Manchu novels, and there are various very good films actually were made, starring people like Christopher Lee, etc., Peter Cushing, in the 1960s and 1970s about Fu Manchu. But in 1941... Sax Rohmer wrote a novel called The Island of Fu Manchu, in which he revealed, I think Rohmer was a member of the Golden Dawn because he wanted to get ideas for his books, basically. A little bit cheeky, but, I mean, very good books they made. And he explains in his book, there's a quote here, from a book called The Island of Fu Manchu, 1941, Chapter 6, Dr. Fu Manchu's Experiments. He says, "My power rests in the east, but my hand is stretched out to the west. I shall restore the lost grandeur of China. When your civilization, as you are pleased to term it, has exterminated itself, when you have reduced to ashes your palaces and your temples, when in your blindness you have set back the clock which so laboriously you fashioned, I shall stir. Out of the fire I shall rise. The dead dusk of the west will have fallen. The golden dawn of the east will come." So there he is. That's the Antichrist himself making it pretty clear that he wants the yin-yang to replace the Abrahamic faiths and their dualism. So that's just one quote. There are various others. I've got another one here, which I mentioned earlier about Adolf Hitler. And this is from a book by Dennis Wheatley I mentioned earlier, the historical novelist and the deception planner from World War II. Page 282 of his book from 1971 called The Devil and All His Works. There's quite a lot of good stuff going on in the early 70s. He says, "There is evidence that Hitler expressed great interest in satanic ceremonies. And an American correspondent writes to me that Hitler once confided to Rauschning..." He wrote a book called Hitler Speaks, which was a bestseller during World War II, because Rauschning had known Hitler before the war. So he was saying, well, this is what this guy's up to, and this is what he told me. So this was a bestseller in England during the Second World War, and in the States too. He said he once confided to Rauschning that he was founding a secret order at the second stage of which a man-god would be worshipped throughout the world. So that's a quote from Dennis Wheatley in his book The Devil and All His Works, 1971, which is not a fiction book. It's a commentary on evil and Satanism. So there's a couple of authors, Sax Rohmer, who was in the Golden Dawn with Crowley, and Dennis Wheatley, who took Crowley to lunch and dinner in order to pump him for information for his novels. That gives us a bit of an idea of what's going on in the world today. Anyway, look, Moeen, it's been fascinating chit-chatting with you. I just think that, you know, quoting these specific individuals that have been buried and forgotten is quite an important way to understand, because they seem to understand in the 1940s, Sax Rohmer, and in the 1970s, Dennis Wheatley, much better what's going on today, and they saw it coming. They were, in a way, prophets in their own right. So I wonder if you've got any closing comments before I just ask you to remind everyone of where to find Global Vision 2000.
No, I think we've covered a lot. And as I said, we've made a decision to do the 12th Global Vision Eschatology conference, which will be online. Others can join on December 14th, a whole day event, interfaith, Christian, Muslim, Jewish. And just to say, by the way, that website of the Sufi is called the Mohammedan Way. I would recommend it strongly as a universal approach to Islamic spirituality in the English medium, the Mohammedan Way. So our website is globalvision.com, and we have on the forum threads. As I said, there's thousands of videos by not any particular, you know, author or production company. It's, indeed, it's even in some other languages. So thank you very much, Tony. There's no doubt about it. We are living in the Islamic term is Jahiliyyah. That's a word that was used to describe 7th century Arabia, where Muhammad alayhi salam came, when you had the Sassanid Empire and the Byzantium. I think in the current world, we have entered another phase of darkness. Jahiliyyah means darkness. And it's not happy story, is it? It's very depressing, you know, anyone following Gaza and Palestine is a very brutal, ruthless, satanic era. But that's why we need hope and we need vision. So thank you for sharing and, you know, discussing some of these topics.
No, well, thank you. And it's been, I think, very interesting to compare from our different Islamic and Christian perspectives. But actually, of course, we all, as well as all honest Jews, Muslims and Christians, honest ones, share the Ten Commandments, which is all very, very clear that you do not bring hell to the Holy Land, and you do not desecrate the holy name of God, which is what the Crusaders were doing back in medieval times, and most definitely the Zionists are doing now. So the idea, it seems to me, like you said earlier, is to create some sort of new religion, a man-made religion, a new age religion of some sort that they wish to roll out upon the earth, and that they're going to try and blame the war they're about to create on the Abrahamic faiths, but they'll fail. And that, I suppose, for me is the blessed hope, the great hope that I may not leave to see it, but it's quite obvious that God is going to win this war.
Yes, inshallah, as we say, God willing, and as I said, Israel is Israel, and it's digging its own, just to end positively, it is digging its own graveyard, I hope. Netanyahu Hitler 2.0, as I call him, listens to that. You are digging your own grave, BB.
Well, he doesn't seem to care, does he? Because he's on. another key thing, I think, is that people should always remember to give thanks to God for the things that they have got now. Look at like Gaza, and that helps us, I think, to give thanks to God for what we've got.
Definitely. I'm getting rid of all my stuff. I really mean it. It's quite a process and preparing for end times. And one of the tasks other than knowledge and spirituality is not to love material. Literally not to have the love of and hold on to material things. Definitely.
Okay, well, that's a pretty good advice. Clear out the loft, folks. Anyway, Moeen Yassin, thanks very much for joining us.
Right, God bless, take care.